Next case, case number 4, Woolley versus Rednauer, 10-3550. Ms. Hollis?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Amanda Hollis, and I represent the appellant petitioner Martin Woolley in this case. We ask that this court reverse the district court's finding and grant habeas. The conclusion that Mr. Woolley was not prejudiced by his counsel's incompetence during his murder trial is unreasonable. This was the question for the jury in this case was, did Marsha Woolley or did Martin Woolley shoot the victims? The prosecution's best evidence against Mr. Woolley was Ogrizek's testimony, the crime scene reconstruction expert, and the confession.
Yeah, I would put them in different order.
Had
the confession was the most important thing.
Either way, no matter which way you view this, had the defendant put an expert on, like Mr. Bush, like we showed during post-conviction proceedings, that expert would have directly and squarely rebutted both of those pieces of evidence and most likely have destroyed them. The issue with the confession...
So does the lawyer have an obligation to get into a battle of experts in a case like that? Why can't the lawyer rely on cross-examination?
And this case presents a perfect example of why you can't just rely on cross-examination in at least some cases. Here, because the lawyer did not investigate any expert testimony or any availability of experts, he was not prepared to ask the state's expert any good questions. If you review the actual cross-examination, he does not once defeat or undercut any of the key opinions of Mr. Ogrizek that the shooter was behind the bar.
This is a very tough case for a defense lawyer when you've got two dead bodies, confession. Apparently, the money that was taken was found, and so on. But is there any evidence at all that Marsha took the fifth? Was she actually called to the witness stand outside the presence of the jury?
No, it was in chambers.
Oh, yeah. But she took the Fifth Amendment.
Right.
Was there any testimony that she ever admitted having committed this crime?
She was not there. She did not admit that she had committed
no,
this crime.
No, she might have said it to somebody. And that's an admission against interest if she had mentioned to one of her friends or something. I really did it, and Martin's taken the fall for me or something.
What she had admitted was that she hated these women and she wanted to get revenge on them. She suspected one of them of having an affair with her husband. And this case is dubious from the perspective of a jury. The prosecution wanted the jury to believe that Mr. Woolley shot his two friends at a bar after having been seen by all of his other friends for the sole purpose of stealing $300 in a cash register and to prove that he could get away with the crime, but then he confessed the next day. That's the story that the prosecution was asking the jury to believe, and that was dubious. Now, had an objective expert come in and said, actually, all of the physical evidence, the evidence that does not lie, points exactly to Marsha Woolley having shot these victims, that could have tipped the balance.
What obligation do we have to give deference to the trial court judge's finding of lack of credibility by your client?
This is a very key issue that I wanted to clarify today. There was no finding that the expert lacked credibility.
And this not that the expert did.
I'm sorry.
I guess you're right. He did go so far as to say the expert was unconvincing.
The expert, this is why this case should be reversed and why this is a clear example of a case where the other courts just got it wrong. The underlying facts for these courts' decisions are incorrect on two very important points. One is the district court said the appellate court upheld the finding that Alva Bush was not credible as a general matter. That's on page 8 of the district court's opinion. That has no support in the record. The most that the circuit court found was that Alva Bush did not convince him, was unconvincing on some of the bases for disagreeing with Ogrizek. Now, we would argue that it's not for a judge to decide whether he is convinced. The jury should have been able to decide that. And he never concluded that no reasonable jury could have found Mr. Ogrizek on any point, much less every point. That is a key misconception, and it comes about from the government's briefs. The government argued this, it was incorrect, and it swayed the courts. The other key mistake here was the appellate court on page, I think it's WA29 of our appendix, said, importantly, the testimony of Alva Bush would not have negated the physical evidence corroborating the confession. It would have. That's, again, an argument brought by the government. If you look at the facts, and as we tried to emphasize so strongly in our briefs, that is absolutely incorrect. The physical evidence does show that the confession cannot be true, could not have happened in the way that Mr. Woolley described in the confession. And the appellate court, by saying this was important to its decision, it signifies that had it understood that fact, it would have gone the other way.
Isn't the principal problem you have is the burden you have coming forward after the fact, particularly if, you're chastised by the prosecution for not accounting for the additional weight that AEDPA tells us to put on the findings by the state court?
It is a challenging case and a challenging burden. We have never denied that. But this case is so unique and so narrow that it absolutely meets the standard. Here, this case goes no farther than this court did in Miller or that other courts have gone, such as the Fifth Circuit and so far and the others that we cited. The omitted evidence here went directly to the key evidence that the prosecution came in with, and its omission left the defendant with nothing. At least in so far, he had an alibi that he could point to. The whole defense did not sit on the narrow shoulders of a guy being tried for murder who, as everyone agrees, his credibility was jeopardized. That's the error that came here. And the evidence that was omitted in our case not only showed that the prosecution's evidence was inconclusive, which is how it worked out in Miller, it went beyond that and showed actually he was innocent, because the shooter was in Marsha's barstool. This case goes so far beyond what this court has already found warrants habeas relief that we believe that we meet the standard.
All right. Do you want to save some time for rebuttal, Ms. Hollis? All right. Mr. Treble, did I say pronounce it correctly?
Good morning. Counsel, may it please the court. I'm Assistant Attorney General Carl Treble, representing the respondent warden. I wanted to start, Your Honor, by pointing out that petitioner's account of the events hinges upon the credibility of his proposed witness, Mr. Bush. The trial court found that the two experts largely agreed on several matters, but then states, and this is on page 15 of petitioner's short appendix attached to his opening brief, then states that Bush did disagree with the state's expert regarding where the shots were fired from, and then says, quote, however, much of the basis for Bush's disagreement is unconvincing, and then gives one example of why he's making that factual determination. That credibility determination is not subject to review in federal court, and that credibility determination is central to petitioner's view that the state's expert was incorrect.
Well, wasn't the judge, in effect, substituting his own expert opinion for that of the state expert with 20 years' experience in crime reconstruction? I mean, when he looked at Bush's report, he essentially looked at one photograph, and he had his belief that the shell casings can't roll against the incline of the tavern's floor. I mean, it is possible that blood could behave differently than a shell casing that is expelled from a gun at a high speed. I mean, wasn't he sort of making his own analysis not based on anything other than his sort of conclusions?
No, Your Honor. He was making his analysis based on the evidence that petitioner put before him, which, of course, it was petitioner's burden to do at that time. If this court reviews the transcript in District Court Docket 1, Exhibit C, petitioner's expert created this after the bar had already been destroyed. So he was creating these pictures and photographs and reconstructing them based on the accounts that were available to him, but not based on actually visiting the crime scene and seeing what the bar actually looked like. Also, the expert admitted that...
But the dimensions that Mr. Bush used didn't change, correct?
I had trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry, the dimensions didn't change. The basic dimensions of the room, the height of the stool, those things had already been put into evidence by prosecution's expert.
Correct, Your Honor, but he admitted that he would have had a better chance to evaluate it if he had seen the actual reconstruction.
Yeah, but doesn't that go back to Judge Williams' point that the...
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Doesn't this go back to Judge Williams' point that these are matters that perhaps would have made a difference to the jury?
Again, no, Your Honor. And another reason why is because in explaining his opinions, the petitioner's expert's main point of contention with the state's expert's testimony was with the state's expert's rebuttal testimony that somebody would have had to have 12-foot arms in order to have fired while standing on that third bar stool. But then the state's expert admits in that testimony to the state trial judge on cross-examination that his reconstruction is just based on somebody standing directly across from the victim. And the state's expert testified, and this is on page 882 of Respondent's Exhibit W, which was docket number 12 below, and in the following pages from that page, the state's expert explains that the reach from directly across from the victim was only 38 inches, and that the 12-foot arms testimony was based on somebody standing at the bar stool, which was in a different location other than directly across. And so the reconstruction is not reconstructing what the state's expert was talking about when the state's expert made this 12-foot opinion. And for those reasons, the state trial court reasonably found that the expert was not convincing.
Well, he gave one example as to why he wasn't convincing, but shouldn't he have also discussed the rest of Bush's conclusions, such as the fact that the bullet lodged in the east door couldn't have come from someone coming from the bathroom?
It may have been...
Because that was a pretty crucial fact.
It may have been preferable for a state court judge to list fact by fact what he believed had occurred based on the discrepancies in the testimony. But again, he made a factual finding, the state trial judge did, that much of the basis for Bush's disagreement with the state's expert was unconvincing. And that factual finding...
Right, but what I was saying, you know, then he should try to take it apart. I mean, I understand what his conclusion is, and I understand he gave one example of that. But there were other things that were said that were pretty germane to the expert's ultimate opinion, and he didn't address those.
And I'm not aware of any case, certainly not from the Supreme Court, stating that a post-conviction judge has to break down fact by fact every reason why they're finding that a witness, be they an expert or a layperson, is credible or not credible.
On the other hand, counsel, it's really unusual to be faced with a situation where even the trial judge couldn't come up with one reason why defense counsel didn't retain an expert. It's pretty stark here, notwithstanding your argument that we still should give deference. No one seems to have been able to come up with a single reason not to have investigated this. In other words, the defense counsel was incompetent.
Going to the performance prong, Your Honor, we would disagree with that statement because the...
Well, I know you would, but if we're going to give deference to the state trial judge on other aspects, it's hard not to give deference to that. He was in the best position to have viewed all of the circumstances, and he couldn't conceive of a good reason.
And that goes to our argument regarding whether or not Harrington v. Richter changed the Wiggins v. Smith splitting of standards, which I think Harrington answers conclusively Just really quickly, Your Honor, it's on page 7, I think it's 785. I'm sorry.
But Harrington doesn't say that we are compelled
right.
to preserve the issue.
The Richter decision states that if there's a multi-part claim, then we don't look at it part by part. We give deference to the last state court opinion to decide on the merits of the constitutional claim. Here, Strickland is one claim, and the last state court to adjudicate it on the merits was the state appellate court, which was silent regarding the performance prong.
Because, again, there's no articulation of a reason that competent counsel would have failed to investigate this aspect, particularly when they knew their client was recanting his confession.
And
I didn't see in your brief any positing of a reason.
Right. A reasonable attorney, Your Honor, could have decided that cross-examination was necessary. As the Supreme Court put it in Richter.
Or was sufficient. Cross-examination was sufficient. That's the argument.
Cross-examination was sufficient. The court in Richter noted, in what this court has characterized as rather vigorous terms, that there's no Newton's third law of evidence. Just because the state puts on an expert doesn't mean that the petitioner's expert has to be brought forward. They can just rely on a cross-examination. And indeed, reviewing the record, the cross-examination was effective.
Yeah, but it didn't deal with some of the science. And I think one of the critical statements the state expert made was it was scientifically impossible for a person sitting on petitioner's wife's stool to make the final shot. So there was no science in the cross-examination.
Your Honor, again, the statement.
Like, you know, dealing with velocity or range or,
right,
you know.
Right. But through cross-examination, Your Honor, and subsequent redirect, the expert clarified that what he meant by the 12-foot statement was somebody standing or kneeling on the bar stool. And petitioner's expert on post-conviction testimony has only produced evidence that somebody standing directly across the bar could have reached over and shot. It doesn't discount the petitioner's or the state's expert's testimony regarding the blood spatter patterns and how those demonstrate that the last shot was fired by somebody standing over the victim, and it doesn't counter his testimony because his testimony was based on the fact that somebody was standing or kneeling on a bar stool would have to have had 12-foot arms. Indeed, the petitioner's expert testified that his diagram, his picture drawing, where it shows, it's in the petitioner's brief, where it shows the rod coming down and impacting the victim's ear, he admitted that that wasn't an exact reconstruction of where the shot had been fired from. It was just meant to demonstrate that he disagreed with the 12-foot arm statement. So, and finally, Your Honors, even if a petitioner had called an expert, there would be no prejudice because of the multiple lies he told in his testimony.
Well, even if the jury discounted both, let's assume the defense expert testified, even if the jury discounted both of the expert opinions, the defendant's claim of innocence would have been much more compelling since his wife seemed to have more motive for commission of the crime and she had the opportunity to do so. Without an expert, there really wasn't much of a chance for the jury to believe the petitioner over the expert who stated that the petitioner's story was scientifically impossible.
Your Honor, I see that my time's up. Could I answer
yes.
your question? It's important to remember that petitioner made multiple confessions and lied to the jury and admitted to lying to the jury when he stated that he brought the gun there in order to do target practice because he planned on doing target practice later that night. He later admitted on cross-examination that that was a lie. He told multiple versions of those events and he stuck with the fact that he lied, and petitioner's counsel was put into an almost impossible situation of trying to defend someone who had made multiple false statements.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
And how much time does Ms. Hollis have?
While we're talking about what prejudice occurred here, if and accepting that the performance prong has been satisfied, the prejudice prong is the issue. I thought there was testimony from a cellmate of his in the jail where he said, yep, it was Martha that had, Marcia that had done the shooting. The cellmate didn't believe him. And then he said, no, really, it was me. I did it. She was with me, but I did it. Now, faced with that, the jury heard, am I correct, there was testimony to that effect?
There was a statement by a jailhouse snitch or informant.
That's what we always call him, a snitch or an informant, but it was somebody.
If you're the defendant.
That's
right.
Yeah. The jury hears that evidence. Now, it's not only a confession to the police, as he did confess to the police, but it's a confession to somebody who questioned his initial story that Marcia had done it.
Your Honor, again, that shows why this evidence should have come in, should have been brought forward. This evidence would have, again, rebutted the Tomsha statement that you're alluding to. In the Tomsha statement, again, Mr. Woolley supposedly said he was behind the bar making that shot. This, again, would have rebutted that. I would like to address a key point that was brought up in the previous argument. Nobody has explained why Mr. Bush could not have been believed by the jury. No court has said that. No argument by the government has been made. Mr. Bush could very well have been believed by the jury. Mr. Ogrizek never explained how that bullet turned 90 degrees after shooting Ms. Turley under his theory and lodged itself in the east door. The state could have tried to explain that, could have brought Ogrizek, could have made its own explanation, but has never done that. No, Mr. Ogrizek did not explain how that abrasion ring or the trajectory of that bullet beneath the floorboards, beneath Ms. Baldwin's head, supported his position. If you look at his testimony, he never refers to that. So there's no explanation as to contradicting Mr. Bush's analysis, which is if you line up those holes in the floorboard and you look at the abrasion ring on Ms. Baldwin's wound, they point in the exact opposite direction where they would have had to go under Mr. Ogrizek's theory. They go straight up to the customer side of the bar, and by the way, that's exactly where Ms. Woolley was located.
What about the comment that that's not, that Bush's positioning of the stool is not accurate with the record and what had been done ergonomically by the prosecution's expert?
For one thing, that demonstrates a battle of the experts and some maneuvers.
Well, except he had the benefit of actually being able to see the scene, correct?
Mr. Ogrizek did. That's the problem here. Because counsel didn't do this when he should have, we don't have the crime scene. The crime scene no longer is there. It burned down. Mr. Treble didn't mention that. We could not have done that. Too much time has passed. And we don't have the bar stool. That is gone. So he did the best thing he could, which was to build the bar to the police's measurements.
But wasn't he required to use the same positioning of the stool as prosecution's expert?
And he did. The testimony in Mr. Bush's examination at the post-conviction hearing is that the stool was centered. He looked at the photographs and compared where the stools were compared to Ms. Baldwin, and he testified it would have been centered exactly where the model was.
So this prosecution statement just isn't accurate with
that
respect.
It's not accurate. And either way, the state argued in closing that it would have been impossible for anyone on that side of the bar to have made the shot. It didn't matter. No one was saying, or Grzyk said, it would have been possible if it had been right in front of her, but not over here. He said it was impossible, without a doubt, no matter where that stool was. Anyone from that side of the bar would not have been able to do it.
Your time is up, Ms. Hollis. We thank you, counsel, for your briefs and your final oral argument. Were you appointed, Ms. Hollis? Were you appointed?
Yes. No, I took it.
Okay. Well, we thank you for your...
They took it pro bono.
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you took it pro bono. So we thank you for your efforts. We couldn't really function in this court without the efforts of your law firm and their allowing lawyers, fine lawyers like you, to represent clients. So thank you. We thank you for your argument as well, counsel. We'll take it under advisement. The next case is U.S. versus